Hello, my name is Cornell Green, and I am the failure guy. Welcome back to the podcast. On this premiere event of our fourth season of the Failure Guy podcast, I'd like to welcome back our guest, Hal Eisenberg. Hal, thank you for joining us once again, and welcome back to the conversation.
Cornell, I am so happy to be here. I had such a great conversation with you last time, even though I completely hijacked your show and went off on a tangent. I was like, we got to do part two.
Yes. Well, no, it's never a hijack, because like I say, that's why I start and I say, welcome to the conversation, not the interview, because it genuinely is a conversation. We found out that we had that connection with music, and we both fell down the rabbit hole. We said hello to the Caterpillar and the Mad Hatter on the way on our trip. And then we finished the first hour. It's like, you know, we never actually started talking about Hal, which is kind of the point of the Failure Guy podcast. People don't tune in to listen to me talk about myself. That could be a whole other thing. But it's like, you know, I got to get you back so that we can talk about you, which is kind of the point and purpose. We did find out some things about you, but your story is so fascinating and amazing. And I did want people to really get to know you. And that's why I asked you to come back. And I can't think of a better way to start the new year and the new season than to bring you back. So first of all, let's once again start by familiarizing you, for those who maybe didn't hear the first part of our conversation last year, with who you are and some of the things that we're going to be talking about in this next hour.
Yeah, I think that's always a loaded question. Like, who am I? I think, you know, by license, I'm a social worker, but obviously there's so many layers to that. I've had an incredible journey of ups and downs and failures and lessons. But as you know, you have to fail to succeed. There's no doubt about that. My passion is geared toward transforming the education system, but I think that's really just where my passion lives. My true vision in life is for everyone to see their power within themselves, to see the light that's in themselves, and to learn how to turn on that switch instead of being, you know, kind of going down that rabbit hole of negativity and thinking they don't have hope. I want everybody to know that about themselves. And I do that through many things. I do it through music, through writing books, through the work I do in the school system. And it's kind of what I live, eat, and breathe for.
Okay, well, that is so fascinating. And particularly, you know, I liked your comment about having people seeing the light within themselves. Yeah. And so first of all, how long have you worked within the school system in your capacity as a social worker?
I've been in the New York City school system now for almost 28 years, which, wow, when I say that number, it's mind-blowing, because I also tell my students I'm not a day older than 33, and I've been doing it since I was 5. And I'm scared about our future, because most of them believe me. So
it's like, you know, that math doesn't math, right?
Exactly. I love when there's a student also that kind of starts to figure it out, and they get that crinkly face, and they're trying to do the math, and they're like, wait, he's 33? But
yeah, it's pretty crazy. So social work, I mean, there's been television series about it. Of course, there's been a lot of movies, yeah, and all this kind of stuff. Sure. And I'm sure people have lots of stereotypes of what they think social work is about. And it's actually an umbrella term. So a couple, yeah, of questions. First of all, what do you think most people hear when they hear social work in the context of the educational system? And what is it to you? Second question. And then third part, how does your approach differ from your typical, if there's even such a thing as your typical academically based social worker? So first, what do you think most people hear when they hear social work?
I think there's this stereotype, and obviously I can't speak for everyone, but I think when you hear the word social worker, you get this vision of a couch and laying down on the couch and somebody with a notepad saying, "Tell me your problems. Tell me how that feels," which I think is the worst question any social worker can ask. Like, how does that make you feel? I also get, I don't
Yes.
know why you asked that question. I get the old Snoopy, Charlie Brown, vision of the booth that says, psychiatrist 5 cents.
Right, Lucy with
Yeah,
the with her hustle.
yes, exactly. And to me, social work is so much more than that. It's so much label. It's a title, it's a license, it's it's technically what I do, but it's not who I am.
Right. Okay. So second part, and I don't even know if I can remember the questions in the order that I asked them because I just was riffing off the top of my head. But when what do you see the purpose, the function of social work in the context? Because you're not like a doing the couch trip, having kids, like you said, sitting there, tell me about your problem modes. How was your childhood? I'm still in it, in the context of the school system, what is the traditional or typical, if there is such a thing, per point and purpose of social work in the school system?
It's an interesting question, Cornell, because I think the way school systems are designed now, I think it probably depends on the particular school and what their needs are. There's so many different aspects to social work, and there's so many different branches that you can go off of. It's really interesting. When I look back at why I, became is a social worker. There's two reasons. There's the humorous reason, which was I was trying to impress a girl, and I wanted a date, right? So I went to school and went into social work. But the more serious reason is I fed into society's model of that economic model of if you wanted to be noticed for what you wanted to do, you needed the degree, you needed the license. And I no longer believe that that is true, though in many fields, you need that quote unquote credibility. So I was doing what was considered the umbrella of social work, and I hit this glass ceiling, and I couldn't go anywhere further in my career, even though I was already starting to build a company. I already had this vision for the world. But to be invited to the table, I needed to have letters, next to my name. I needed that license. So from the get-go, I always have like kind of redefined what social work, is. I went into the school system going, I'm going to shake things up. I have a vision. I have a dream. So my answer to that question has really been blurred from day one. From a school's perspective, it's honestly to fill checkboxes. We need counseling done in this area. We need, this supported. We need to look good. So I need to make sure that there's a social worker in the building. But the sad thing is not even all schools have a social worker. Yeah.
Okay. And
That was a
like,
lot. I just
no. Like so many things in our society, there's the surface, the ostensible reason that, back in the day, somebody had genuine interest and thought it was a good idea. And then over time, it's just like, well, this is the thing that we need to do. Why do we need? Because we need to do it. Because it's on the thing. And do we have one? Yeah. Okay. Good. What are they doing? Doesn't matter. We've got one. They're in there. They're in the office. We check the box off. Inspectors come around. They say, yep. No, there he is. There she is. See, social worker. There's the thing. Bye. And the intention, the actual sincere intention, kind of gets lost in that. Which leads me to my third question. And again, hearkening back to what you said in your introduction. To have people, see the light within themselves. What is Hal Eisenberg's approach to social work, as opposed to whatever the heck the official thing is, and who really cares at this point?
Sure. I love that question. For me, social work is holding space for somebody, holding the container for somebody to explore themselves, to be in power and to figure out how to elevate who they are. Explore, empower, elevate is kind of what I would describe as my version of social work. It's having a safe space for people to navigate life every day, to figure out like who they are, what they're about. And then that's not sit on the couch and I'm going to tell you how to fix your problems type of mentality. That's about commitment and consistency and everyday conversations and kind of flowing with people's energy and challenging them, in the right moments to be like, hey, have you thought of things this way? And also not being social work to me isn't there's this mentality in society, whether it's social work or the medical field, it's like you have the license, so you need to you must have all the answers. I never go into social work that way. It's a conversation, right? It's I learn just as much from my students as they learn from me. And I said day one, I set that up with them when they come into my office. I say, listen, I don't know everything. I have a lot of experience that I'm more than happy to share with you if you want to have those conversations, but I am never going to tell you like this is the way, right? We're going to explore together. I'm going to learn from you. You're going to learn from me. We're on equal playing field from day one. And what that does is it sets up a level of respect. It sets up a level of authenticity. And they're like, oh, like my voice matters, my life matters. And that to me is what social work is. It's making sure that somebody knows that their life matters, that we're in this together. And I'm not perfect, right? I have my days, I have my good days and my bad days. And let's journey together. I also let them know that I feel blessed to be in this role. I don't know how I got into this role. I don't know how this, how I became this person, but social work to me is like, it's a blessing, that I get to journey with whoever's in front of me.
Okay, wow, that's very powerful. Now you mentioned sort of three phases of your approach: explore, empower, and elevate. And first of all, I'm kind of a nutcase for alliteration, so I like the fact that it's three E's, and I'd like to sort of walk through all three of those, and how that what that looks like in terms of dealing with a student. And so first of all, exploration. Just give us an idea. What does that look like as you explore with one of your charges, if you will?
First of all, it's listening. It's not cutting somebody off. Really listening. It starts off with listening intently, having, somebody feel safe. And then asking clarifying questions that might be layered with hints of, well, can you share this with me? It's designed for the person in front of you to go a little deeper, right? So you want to create that space for them to explore all the possibilities. Like, why was mom angry with you? Did something happen? What do you think mom's going through? Why do you think that teacher, gave you so much homework? And it could be dramatic. I don't know, but what you're doing is you're helping them to explore, and then they process through at their own pace.
Okay. Wow. And that's actually, again, fascinating. It's why I asked you the question, because I knew there was going to be an interesting answer. And I'm sure that helps create a context of like, I have a very good friend that I speak with quite a lot, and he always uses the term, what is it, to redirect and not to correct.
I love that. Absolutely, 100%, yes.
And I like that. And that kind of segues, I see how that segues into, from exploration to empowerment. Now, empowerment, kind of an overworked term. It's almost kind of being
100%.
like a buzzword, but I of course get in the context of our conversation that it's more than just, lip service to you. And I can see as you're walking through how your exploration aspect works, I can see how that will segue into empowering this student. So say a little bit about that part.
I could sum it up. I like alliteration also, so that's why I stuck with the word empowerment. But empowerment to me is actually I translate it to two other words, and it's what's possible. One of the things that I discuss with people, I share with them that in any situation that I'm in, where I'm challenged or I'm exploring or I'm questioning or I have some kind of heavy emotion where it's hurt, pain, anger, frustration. I've trained the muscle, and it is a muscle. It's like going to the gym. You have to work this muscle out. I train myself to stop, to respect the emotion that I'm in, to realize that whatever I'm feeling is valid, and to ask myself the question, what's possible here? What's possible with my anger toward my mom? Is there a wound that I need to heal? Do I need to learn patience? Do I need to learn communication? Do I need to plan an exit strategy from my home? Because, I just not seeing eye to eye, So the quest for empowerment, and when you give somebody that simple tool, what's possible here? That's empowerment, because now you give them the ownership of saying, I'm not the victim, right? Yes, my life feels a mess, but the mess is a message, right?
I
There's
like that.
the wound is wisdom, right? What's possible here? So that's what empowerment is to me.
Okay. And I like that distinction because it's not giving somebody a magic formula or 10 super aphorisms or something like that, but it's seeing within them. I like that you said what is possible with this anger, and we don't normally think of anger as something we can constructively explore or utilize. So that right there is quite fascinating. And as you say, to have them, you're not, yes, you're young, yes, you're in school because you have to be here, yes, you're subject to the discipline of your parents, but you're not a victim, you're not powerless. You have the ability to look at yourself, look at the situation, and to make choices and decisions. And that's pretty, and I'm sure that for some of the kids that you deal with, that's a first for them.
Oh, 100%. When I go out on stage and I do my signature, speech about which is titled Your Life Matters, I always share the story about how I learned that lesson along the way. And the first time I had heard those three words, was well into my teen years, 17, and I was going through, my life was a mess. And I realized no one had ever told me that I matter, that my life mattered, that I was enough by just showing up and breathing. And even when I got that message, it took me years to really understand truly and to really feel and embody the fact that my life matters. And what I find with this generation, it's even worse. Like, there's so many kids that are lost and hurting and in pain. And it's a different generation. They're impacted by social media and things coming at them a million miles per hour, and their brains are not adjusting quick enough and processing enough. So, that's what we're seeing, and that's what we're labeling as anxiety and stress and depression, and that's when drug addiction happened. All those things are symptoms of something really simple, of them not realizing that they matter just for who they are. And I find that all the time when I'm speaking to kids, they don't know that. So it is the first time that they're hearing it.
Wow. I've shared on most of my podcasts, I talk about my mother and how significant an influence on my life that she was. I certainly, from as far back as I can remember, was told that I am someone, that I have abilities, that I'm only limited by my ambition and the choices that I make in my life. I had very loving family, my maternal grandmother, my maternal great grandmother, aunts and uncles, cousins, family, friends. So it's kind of like a fish is unaware of water. And as we shared in part one of our conversation where we went down the rabbit hole, I spent about 8 years in my 20s in New Jersey chasing my rock and roll dreams. And that was the first time in my life when I encountered people. I wouldn't say I was sheltered, but my mother very consciously curated the environments of what we were exposed, who she would have over to the house, who we would go have sleepovers with, you know, the things we do, culture events, schools we went to, after school events, all these sorts of things. And so I just took it for granted that everyone's life was like that until I went out into the world on my own and I met people in generational poverty. I met people from broken homes. I met people from good homes, but they didn't necessarily have the structure, or they had the structure, but they rebelled foolishly against it. You know, and then I realized, oh, this is not universal, you know. And to see that, you know, what I just took for granted, not only was it not universal, but to see the effects of those who did not have that, like you said, who never had anyone in their lives that told them, you're somebody, you're okay. Not even that you're amazing, but you're okay, you matter, you're significant. You know, and some of the things, and when you live in poor neighborhoods, and you, the things, the way that some parents speak to their kids, the things, and then it's not even that they're physically abused, but I think in a lot of ways, the psychological abuse and the emotional abuse and the verbal abuse is far worse. Hit me, and the sting will go away. But you can say some things to me that linger in my soul, you know, permanently.
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt. When I was working with the Passion Center up in Toronto, Canada, one of the lessons I learned is like from that young age of 4 to 8, 9, 10, there's a programming that's happening inside of you, and things and moments that parents or experiences you'll have, or even not even that they'll say to you, but that you'll witness, that teaches your brain a lesson, right? And then we adapt that lesson, and we believe like the world is scary, or we believe that we're not worthy, and we don't even know that it's from that programming. It's just in that DNA, until somebody coaches us to see what's going on internally, and we don't have a society or a school system that does that. But once you do find that, you can't unsee what you see. And unfortunately, we don't have an education system that is designed to help students be empowered in that way to look at what that messaging and that program is. And that's kind of what I'm about. That's ultimately what I truly want to do, is transform the education system so that it is designed for everybody to see their light and the gifts and talents, with the overarching idealistic idea that this is what's going to actually improve our planet and move humanity forward. That's the springboard effect.
Okay. And I can see why the first element of your approach is that exploration. And listening to you right now, I am just made aware of the fact that there are so many things that we learn and are taught that are neither conscious by the source of those educations. We just see things. People don't understand the way that they're behaving, the things that they're saying, not even to me as a child. To each other, to random strangers, or just the way someone silently by themselves is behaving in the presence of a child. And that gives instructions, that gives lessons, and it's nonverbal and it's not intentional on the part of those people. And it's not, so I'm not saying, oh, this, therefore that. I'm just taking this in sort of by osmosis, but I'm taking away a lesson. And unless I explore it, I don't even know where I got that from. I don't even know where I got that belief from.
And I'll even say this. I got to be very cautious how I word this. I almost don't blame the parents, because it's a generational thing, right? Because they went to the same schools that didn't teach them how to turn on that light. So it's very easy for everybody to point the finger and say, oh, it's the parents' fault. But they had parents also, and they also went to school. I used to say jokingly, without the research that I now have and the background and the experience I now have, but I used to say, if my grandparents always said that they hated school, and my parents said that I hated school, and I hated school, maybe it's the school system, right? Right, there's a pattern here, right?
Yes. I have something that I used to say about myself and relationships, that if it's more than three, it must be me. And what I meant by that was, if I have three bad relationships in a row, what's the common element? It's not her or her
It's
or
me,
her. It's me.
right?
So, but you're saying if
Yes.
I got three, we got three generations, and they're all
Right.
coming away with the same conclusion about school, maybe it's not just the generations. Okay?
Yes.
Because they all three generations hate school. It might be the school. But
Yes.
I want to loop back to your distinction, and I appreciate this about the parenting. To my mind, there's a difference between poor parenting and bad parenting. To me, bad parenting is you yourself, the way you're approaching being a parent is bad because you're either neglectful or abusive or dismissive or whatever. But if you were a poor parent, it's because you weren't given the tools to be any better a parent than you are. You're not trying to
Yeah.
be a bad parent. You're doing the best that you can, but as good as you can isn't very good because you didn't have good examples, you didn't have preparation, you yourself were not educated, you're stuck in the cycle of abuse that you inherited and you don't even realize that. So you're
Yeah.
passing, well, this is the way my parents did it and my grandparents did it. Yeah, well, that way sucks.
Yeah.
But if you don't know that there are even choices, what can you do except but repeat the pattern that you were given? No one gives you a handbook. There's no operation manual in the maternity ward, and it's just like, like you probably heard it in your line less of time. You have to get a license to own a pet, but anyone can have a child, and it's kind of said, lightly and aloofly, but it's true. There's no standards. No one gives you a 25-point checklist, to take that kid out of that maternity ward. And I was watching some videos, from the perspective of newborn mothers, like YouTube shorts and things like that. And something, because I'm not a woman and I've never had a child, of saying the sort of the panic they feel as they're being released from the, it's like, wait a minute, you're gonna let me get out here with this new human being? I don't know what the I'm doing. Seriously? And it's like, oh my God, I thought, oh my baby. And it's like, they're like, no, I almost shit my pants. when the immensity, it was like, I have absolutely no idea what to do with this living being is dependent on me, and I'm clueless.
And it's interesting to me too, because as you're saying that, I wonder two things. One, I wonder if there's an overlap between what you're describing as a poor parent and a bad parent. And I didn't expect to speak about this today, and I don't usually speak about this, but I was a teenage father, and it's interesting because my life was a mess, a really struggled mess, and I could have very, very, very easily fallen into that generational trauma of being a bad parent, and a poor parent, because I definitely didn't have the tools to be a parent, and I definitely didn't have, there was no handbook, right? Step one, step two, step three, this is what you're going to do. I don't know what it is and why this doesn't happen to other people, but I suspect it happens to some. When my son was born, I literally remember sitting there and processing, I've got to get my shit together. Like, because I am responsible for this life and I want to be somebody that he's proud of. I want to be somebody that he can look up to. That's honestly probably, I quote a lot of things that have saved my life, and it takes a village for sure, and a lot of different experience. But I think that's one of the major transitional moments is seeing him born and going, oh shit, that's mine. Like, what am I gonna do? But I wonder why that doesn't happen for other parents. And I joke about this but I'm wondering now, as we're having this conversation, what the biology is behind this. But I remember saying, I don't know how to be a parent. I'm just going to do opposite of what my parents did. That was my handbook. And no offense, I love my parents, right? I learned that they had limitations and they loved me the best that they could at the time, right? That's a whole other social work, psychological journey that I was on, right? It's very easy to say something and people go, oh my God, he had a horrible relationship with his parents. We were all learning. We were all on this journey together. I know part of my healing is I no longer fault them, but that's actually what I did. There was no handbook. I said, I'm gonna do the opposite. And I'm really proud of my son. He turned out wonderful.
Okay, that's amazing. And again, that's back to the second E, empowering. That sounds like it was an empowering experience for you, because we hear the teenage mother, the teenage father, and it's usually in the a very special episode of, or the like, because I'm 65 years old, so growing up watching a lot of these made for TV movies of the 70s, and they're about the tragedy, keep it in your pants, kid, because otherwise this will happen, and look at this, ah. And it's like, but the flip side of that, it's like, yeah, I was a wreck and a mess, and then here's this life, and it's like, I am responsible for this living, breathing creature. So playtime's over, kids. I don't know what or how right now, but I know that I have got to do better. Got to
And
do better.
it wasn't like, and I share this with a lot of parents, it wasn't like the next day I woke up and
Of
I was the
course not.
perfect parent, right? Like there was a lot of learning curves along the way, for sure. Life still happens.
Yeah, definitely. And so we've spoken about enlightenment and we've spoken about empowerment, and very well, I like the way that you elucidated on that. Notice another E word.
Yeah, less
And
of
so I can see how that sort of segues into, and this is the thing that I don't normally hear, because I know people who are in, the psychological professions and counseling and life coaches and things of this nature. But the final E I find very interesting, particularly since you're talking about a young audience, which is to elevate. So please, enlighten us about that.
And I will tie in the enlightenment, but we can go for you too. So Elevate to me is interesting as well. As with the other two, I do have a different definition, and I honestly see it as a mathematical equation. When you explore and then you feel powered, explorement plus empowerment equals elevation. And what I notice is when students, youth, and even adults are exploring and asking that question, what's possible, having that ownership of empowerment, then they create the most amazing things. They transfer it into the world. They elevate. They run conferences. They build curriculums. I have teenagers building curriculums saying education should be done this way. I want to teach my peers this way. I have them creating businesses and working, with the homeless, because when you teach somebody how to see that light through exploration and through empowerment, they use that light to shine it on the world. They use that light to elevate. So elevation is not just them. Now they realize I matter, I have power, and now I want other people to feel what I'm feeling. And that's the elevation. The elevation is the collective.
Wow. It broadens the scope. That's truly amazing. I'm so glad. First of all, of course, I'm glad to have you back in this conversation. I'm glad that we're getting into you. I mean, as much as I love talking about music, but that is, I mean, there's a saying, and as someone myself who develops educational content and who creates workshops, I wrote my first book basically out of my first few years of entrepreneurship and all the stuff I didn't know, and realizing that other people needed to know that as well. There's a saying, the teacher teaches what the teacher needs to learn. And
100%.
for these
100%.
students, and but I what I love is that you're sharing that kids, because a kid could just say, hey, great, I'm getting myself, I'm charging my battery up, I'm shining my lamp a little brighter, yay me. But that so many of them say, oh, wait a minute, I can take this, I want to teach what I've learned. I want my peers to get this gift and to
That's
this
right.
experience and this awareness. And
Yeah.
that's just so amazing. And like, I'm a systems guy, a computer nerd, and I've been a actually as of next month, I will have been an IT professional more than half of my life. I turned
Wow.
65 last month, and next month will be the 33rd year that I've been an IT professional.
Wow.
And I started in Unix and Wall Street firms, and so Linux is one of my favorite operating systems, and one of my favorite distributions in Linux is called Ubuntu.
Okay.
Which is a word that means I am because we are.
Oh, I
And
love that.
that is what I like about that operating system. I like the meaning of that, and I like the Ubuntu concept just in my personal life. And it's sounding to me like that elevation enlightens and exposes kids to the Ubuntu within themselves.
100%, 100%. And when they have those three components, it's not like each component happens, in isolation.
Right,
They're all
right.
happening together. And that brings me to the fourth E, because I believe that when those three E's are working together, that's the journey to enlightenment. So when you think about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and people
Right,
say,
right.
that's impossible to reach that mountaintop, I don't believe that. I think that's the one area where Maslow had it wrong. I actually think enlightenment is actually complete unconditional love, and it's the combination of those three E's, and that's what gets you to the journey of enlightenment. And that's actually what my more recent book, Whispers in the Rain, is actually about.
Okay. Wow. That's and you don't normally hear stuff like this in someone talking about doing social work in the academic system. Usually you think, urban areas, underfunded schools, keeping kids from joining gangs and out of poverty. And of course, I'm sure some of that might be in your work, but it so much more catering to the person, the human soul, if you will. And I know for some people that might be a lofty kind of phrase, but deal with it. Because, and also seeing the educational system as more than just read and write and arithmetic, teaching people to be good minions as they go and work in a factory or sit behind a desk and make a billionaire into a trillionaire, But the purpose of education is to create the best person, and the best person and people create the best society, the best country, the best nation, the best world,
Absolutely.
As a bit of a, amateur historian myself, and I'm sure you know from your years of experience in the educational system that the original liberal arts now means you don't have a specialty, and it's kind of looked down as you just got a liberal arts degree. But the original concept of liberal meaning generous or plentiful, the concept was that you were exposed to many different structures and disciplines to make you a well-rounded citizen. So you learn some of the mathematics, you learn some literature, you learn some science, you learn some art, you learn some music, so that you had were exposed to all of the things that would make you a good and productive citizen as part of the community. Now, because everything's so focused on you got to get the sheet, like you said, the letters after your name, so you can go there and negotiate for higher salary. Yeah, but are you educating the mind, the soul, and the spirit? Are you making a better person, or are you just making someone who's a good capitalist?
Right. You're feeding the economic model. The truth of the matter is our education system was designed to feed the needs of the Industrial Revolution. There's so much material on this out there, and there's so much open discussion about that. This is what the education system was designed, and there are definitely pockets and programs here and there that try to do the reverse, but largely we're still running the same system, a system that was designed to create factory workers, not a system that was designed to help people activate their passion, and help them to be well-rounded or help them to develop their gifts. We teach people that their grades matter more than their gifts, and that spills over into adulthood. Evaluations, accolades, diplomas, your title is more important than your internal gift, without even having the conversation that, it's your gifts that matter, and that's what's going to push humanity forward.
And that's such a powerful phrase, Hal, that we teach people that their grades matter more than their gifts. And that is so true. And I'm sure that with your experience, you're familiar with, John D. Rockefeller and Frederick Gates and the General Education Board, and exactly what you're saying. Back in the early 1900s, they crafted our current nationwide educational system. And of course, Frederick Gates' famous quote that we don't want a nation of thinkers, we want a nation of workers.
Which is mind blowing, right? And you look at society now, and this is where my brain goes, is like, it's like back in, I believe it was, I don't want to say middle e the was it medieval, when the Catholic Church was the center of society, and there was a springboard that the church was involved in politics, in whatever, in the family life, and the laws and the money and that kind of, right? I can easily make the argument that that's what the school system is doing now, right? And as the Catholic system has, as the Catholic Church ha now has lost its power, so has the school system. And you can make the argument that all these systems are broken because the people running those systems went to those schools, to all the same schools that didn't teach them to shine their light, that taught them to be dummied down and not be inspired. And those are our leaders today. That scares
And
me.
it's such a relevant point that you raise, the power back in the day. And I believe, yeah, it was in what we call the medieval period of history. Think about it. I believe both Copernicus and Galileo, their research was funded by the church. And yet the church, which was the not only the keeper of the knowledge, but was the benefactor, and the funder of the knowledge, says, "Oh, this is great knowledge. No one can know this." Because we have to keep the myths and fallacies that perpetuate our power. So yeah, we realize, yeah, thank you, Copernicus, the universe doesn't revolve around the sun, but we will kill you if you tell anybody that. It's like, but wait, you paid for the, yeah, shh, keep that, And so we have school systems that are intentionally dumbing people down, giving them minimal capabilities, and of course, don't give them any powers of critical thinking, because then they can see all the BS that's happening in the political and economic structures that are keeping them down. If they realize that they have the power, then we don't have any control over them. And our goal is to give them just enough education to be controlled and to be useful.
And the scary thing is, it's such a monster of a system, that there's so many people embedded in the system that don't realize that their role is feeding that, right? That they just see themselves as like, I'm doing my job, I'm doing it great. They don't even have the awareness that it's hurting the masses, or hurting the collective. But then again, right, that's the human journey, right? Like, we're all in this together. And my hope is, not to point the blame to those individuals, but hopefully to inspire them also to explore, be empowered, and elevate, their journey, because we're all in this together, right? So I think I do believe, I believe in humanity, and I believe we can transform the system. And just like Galileo and who you mentioned, like,
Copernicus, yeah.
it was generations before society, caught up to all those secrets that were hidden. So I don't know, Cornell. Maybe we're 7 generations ahead of the game, and somebody's going to talk about how this crazy guy Hal, had this transformational education framework, and now we're implementing it. I'm okay with
Well,
that.
speaking of which, you have set quite a lofty goal for yourself. I mean, it's one thing to want to do good things and good work with the kids that you deal with, but you mentioned earlier that you seek minor goal of transforming the educational system.
Small goal, you know. Small 2026 goal, you know. Some people want to get in shape for New Year's Eve.
I want to transform
I'm going big.
education. So what does that look? I mean, we can joke about it, but I know that you're very serious about that.
Sure,
So
sure.
say more about that.
A lot of people, I've been accused of being an idealist. I've been accused of, jokingly, somebody once called me or called me several times that I had a Gandhi complex, which I'm like, okay, I mean, I'll take it as a compliment. It wasn't meant as a compliment for sure. But I just feel like we can do better. Now, is there a realistic side? Like, am I going to be the person to transform education? I'm not that, naive. I think there's a lot of amazing people out there doing amazing work that needs to come to light. Can we have better conversations and better systems and better programs and better schools? 100%. And I think it has to start by, being on podcasts and having these tough conversations and sharing with the world and doing writing books. I have a 10 book deal with my publishing company, all on different aspects of transforming the education system and highlighting really successful stories of former students and teachers and professionals and parts of the system that kind of get snuffed by all the negativity. It's like they're under like 100 feet of snow, but there is that little light. I want the world to see what they're all doing. So it's not just me per se, but I do feel like I want to be the facilitator of the conversation. I've built curriculums and programs and frameworks that even change the language. I think things there's certain mentalities around when you hear the word teacher or you hear the word student. What if we stopped calling people students and we started calling them explorers?
Oh.
What if teachers became facilitators, right? They were facilitating that exploration. Simple little changes like that. This doesn't have to be a major overhaul. It has to be a discussion of what is the purpose of education? Is it really to feed the economic model? Or do we want to stop? Like, when we look out the window and there's, rape and violence and drugs and wars and, political tension and immigration issues, and this is not to have a political conversation, right? But does the conversation want to be, how do we move this planet forward? Can education be designed to simply have us do better? And for us to do better, it means learning better for ourselves, being more passionate, learning how to activate that internal passion, instead of this idea that passion is something that you chase, right? And have the notion that if we do that with all of our citizens, or at least attempt, the effort will make the planet a better place. So when I say transform education, it's kind of like when we started this conversation of like, what do you hear when you hear social work, right? It's a lot bigger. What do I mean when I say I want to transform education? Kind of the same thing. I want people to see their light and I want them to do better in the world. Maybe it's not about, A plus B equals C, and you need to do this system and you need to put this there. Though I do design that. And I do all those data analysis tools and all those fancy things in education, right? But it's bigger. It's bigger. I simply want people to know that they matter, they have a light, and we can do better. And education can be the vehicle that will drive our planet forward.
Okay, wow, that is a lot, and that is wonderful, and it's interesting because it kind of resonates with what I'm working on. I'm working on my second book, and I don't have any 10 book deal, and I'm self-published. But my next book that I'm working on is called Born Again Capitalist, and
Nice.
the subtitle is, run a for-profit business without sacrificing your soul.
Ooh, I love
And
it.
my thesis is there's tends to be this mindset that you're either going to be a good person or you're going to be a successful capitalist. And to be a successful capitalist, you got to break necks and step on heads and, you know, and cut throats. And I'm like, no, you don't. You know, and right. I think in the educational model, we're so transfixed from you know, Rockefeller and Gates and the mindset they put us in, and we have to create minions to work in the factories and the office buildings. And it's like, what if you teach people to be good people, then you're going to destroy American capitalism. It's like, that's ridiculous. I totally reject that notion. In fact, I submit that if we take your model and your approach to what educate, and I love that facilitators and explorers, just by changing the words and the models and the mindsets, you know, we can do all of the good things. We can increase the GDP, and we can then the flow, and the Dow Jones will thrive, and all this kind of stuff. But if we only focus on those things to the expense of the human experience and the human soul, then we're going to have all of those societal problems, all of the breakdowns, you know, all of the misery, you know.
Yeah,
and absolutely. Part of it, I think, and speak to this as we wrap things up, I'm sure, unfortunately, that there are people in the educational system who are in it for a place of power, for a position of authority. And they sure. would be the gatekeepers and the roadblocks towards what to me seems like a simple transformation. Like if you simply implemented your first thing, let's just change what we call ourselves. You can right. do the same things. You can work with the same syllabus and curriculum. Just right. change what you call yourself. And that mindset shift alone would be a powerful transformation, but no,
absolutely.
I'm a teacher, I'm a principal, I'm a blah, 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 an administrator, and that's gonna take my power away. But it's not about your power, is it?
No, it's not about the power. And you're right, there are a lot of people in this system that are there for ego. You know, the system is also designed to, in that process of, I hate to use this language, but dumbing people down, the system was designed to capture people to work in that system. You know, there's a lot of people that are there that, you know, I'll use this as an example. I see a lot of amazing young teachers come in and the first 5 years, they've got ideas and they're excited, you know, and then speak to them on day one of year six. And they're like, how many years do I have till retirement? You know, or I can't leave because I have medical insurance or I have bills, you know, they feel trapped and they're uninspired. You know, Deloitte did a study, 87%. What they found in the study is 87% of North Americans were uninspired and not feeling passionate at their jobs. Now apply that to the education system.
Wow.
If 87% of our staff and administrators are not inspired, what does that mean to the youth that they're teaching, right? And you see a lot of that manifesting in these behaviors of I'm in charge and I need to check these check boxes, because you're dealing with the human spirit also, right? Everybody has their own journey. You know, again, it goes back to that label of social worker. You know, we see teacher, we see administrator, we see, you know, assistant principal, whatever the title is. And we think that we get a certain image. What we don't see it all the time is the person behind that title, right? They have their own story behind the story. They have their own journey, their own wounds, their own struggles. They're trying to figure out how did I get here? How did I become this person? And now I have this responsibility, but they haven't worked through it. And that is the spillover you see. That's the ego you see, or the teacher yelling at the kid, and then the kid's feeling horrible, and then you go home to a dysfunctional house. It's all this negativity is just crashing and feeding each other. So it's complicated. The answer is not as easy as saying, hey, there's this guy Hal here who wants to transform the system. This is layered.
Yeah, yeah. And I have friends and peers that are in education in various levels and aspects. And one of the things that I've heard is that you mentioned that the newbie teacher that comes in all, you know, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. And I actually read somewhere that a lot of new teachers burn out within the first 5 years.
100%. I've seen it. Yeah.
and it's insane. And analogous, we don't want to go that help, but that also happens in the policing, because I have peers who have served in the NYPD and various other police forces, and the cops that tend to become the most corrupt and abusive are not the ones who go in it as cynical, but it's the ones who go in with all the idealism, and that they're going to be Adam 12 or something like that, or Joe Friday, and then they see the morass of the system. They see the corruption that's there. They see the disinterest and inattentiveness, and they're just like, oh well, F this. If that's the case, and they either quit, or if they stay, wow, they tend to become a lot of the times the cops you don't want to run into, because they had their hearts broken. A lot of times it's the ones who's like, eh, I'm gonna do my 20, I'm gonna get my pension, as long as I don't get shot or have to shoot anybody, and if I do have to pull my gun, better them than me, but I'm not looking for a fight. It's a decent job. I mean, it was that or working at my dad's construction firm. And I don't want to, mix cement. So I'm gonna do this, and then I get a good pension. I'll buy a house. I'll go retire in the South somewhere. And it's all it is to me. What? It's protect and serve. Yeah, whatever. And I'm sure, like you said, there's a lot of teachers like, look, it's a good job. Once I get tenure, then I'm just gonna ride the coast till I can retire. Cash out and buy my retirement home and adios, muchachos.
And a lot of people are happy with that, and that's the way the model was designed, right? That's that linear economic model, and we're fed that from a young age. Go to college, get a good job, get married, have the white picket fence, get a promotion, retire, travel, die.
Wow. Wow.
And that equals a good life. Maybe have some kids in there too, right? And then feed them the same economic model, right? Because tell them they have to do the same thing. But life is mosaic, right? I think we're discovering that as we get into these further generations. Like, life is not linear. It's okay. Like, I remember my family being disappointed that I wasn't going to be a bus driver. My dad drove this,
Oh,
my
wow.
grandfather was a subway operator. My dad, my uncle were bus drivers, all great people, right? When I told them I was going to be a social worker, they thought I was insane. Like, don't
But the
start your own
family
business.
business.
The family business, right? You need a retirement, you need good insurance, you need a city job. That's what will make you successful. But that was that generation, right? Like, that was what they told. But like, life isn't like that. It's okay now to work somewhere and then 10 years later say, hey, I think I have another interest now. Polypassionate, I think is the terminology.
I like that. I like that. And as we got into in our first hour, as we're wrapping this one up, I spent almost a decade in most of my 20s chasing my rock and roll dreams in the Jersey Shore, and I did not have any lasting success. There are no albums in stores. There is no documentary of the early days of any of my bands. But the more I get into working for myself, and this is now my 16th year of being independent, I see that the things that was not wasted time. Now, when I first came back in the 90s and started my IT career, I did sort of feel, wow, I just blew like a decade. I should have gone to college and blah, 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 blah. But even the corporate IT success and the stuff I'm doing now and the workshops and the book that I wrote and the various things that I've done were informed by that, by chasing that dream, by chasing that passion. The things I learned from being on a stage of playing a cold audience that's, they're here, the amp, the band, you're just opening act, and winning them over by the third song, or having some guy was gigging in his band and he booked a Tuesday show at a club in the village, and it's like, no, you get booked at that place. You don't borrow a loan against your father's, corporate, account. And we play to three people: the waitress, the bartender, and the sound engineer.
I've had nights
Okay.
like
Yes.
that
Now we entertain the heck out of them. They love the show.
Sure.
And I just learned, well, you play to the room that shows up. And so I remember the first time I did a workshop, and I put together a nice PowerPoint presentation, and the room's filling up. I was working with Harlem Business Alliance, and I saw these people coming in. It's like, wait a minute, I don't know anything about teaching people anything. What the heck is going on? And I started to panic. I thought, Cornell, this is just playing another cold room.
That's
You know how
right.
to do this. You know how to pay attention. You know how to focus on the one or two really engaged people, and you speak to the room through them. You know how
That's right.
to see whether people are checked in or checked out. And I did so well. I was only supposed to do that at the end of that first year and come back in the spring. They booked me the next month, when I filled the
Right.
room. It's like, oh, so all of those skills of being extemporaneous, that wasn't just about music. That wasn't just about spoken word poetry. That can apply to every aspect of my life.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely. Yeah. And none of it is a waste. It's funny because I used to joke, and I still joke sometimes. I tell people that when I was younger, I told the universe that I wanted to tour the world. Of course, I meant as a rock and roll star, right?
Obviously.
Right, but the universe heard toward the world, and I'm doing books and public speaking engagements and working in schools and remote countries and developing countries, and I've been blessed to go around the world, not with my drum set and not playing behind a rock band. But you know what? It's all beautiful, right? Like, I used to beat myself up saying I was 10, 15 years behind because I didn't do X, Y, and Z. But the truth of the matter is I was in boot camp, and I was training for what was coming next. That was my version of university, my version of college, and the school of hard knocks, so to speak. And none of it's bad. I'm blessed to be the man that I've become through the challenges, through the failures, through the lessons. I love who I am and where I'm at. And I actually love that I didn't take the traditional linear, model that was drilled into me when I was a kid. So I actually call that success now. And do I know everything? No, like, I'm still learning, and I'm just present to all of it, and I'm blessed.
And because I feel this sort of same way, you sort of got the universe university. It didn't happen
Yes.
in the halls of academia necessarily, or at some prestigious, Ivy League school, but you did get the education, in fact, in some ways a richer education
Yeah,
for it,
100%.
And
Yeah.
well, Hal, first of all, thank you so much for helping me launch the fourth edition of the Failure Guy podcast. A wonderful conversation. I'm glad that we actually got to talk about you in this hour because you have such an amazing story. And
Thank you.
of course, folks, I'm going to get the link to Hal's books. I'm going to put that in the show notes when we publish this. And is there anything that's coming up for you? Anything you'd like to share as we wrap things up?
Yeah, the next 90 days, Cornell, I'm taking on. I like to push the envelope and see, what's possible for myself. So I've got some major events coming up. My band of 28 years, to go back to our first show, I can't even believe I'm in a band for 28 years. That's insane to me. With Regina at the helm, we're the I'm calling it headlining act. We're the only act, but we're doing. I'm running a 4-day retreat in Toronto and New York City back to back on 2 weekends, and the band is going to play both Saturday nights. So we're doing. I think it's April 25th in Toronto, and then May 2nd in New York City. So we're super excited about that. And then I have a youth-led conference in March for 600 people, and then we're servicing the community of Queens. We're gonna 250 families in need. In between those two musical events, smack in
And
the
what's the
middle,
name
I'm
of
gonna
your
do this
band?
event.
What's the name of your band? Oh,
Outlet. Yes. We have
wow.
two social workers and a psychologist in the band. So whenever the band would get into fights, it was more like group counseling. So.
Well, that may be why you've been together for 28 years.
Exactly. They're family. They're a lot of fun. We're raising money for two an education and a cancer charity, cancer research. So we're excited about that. The band's raised over 100 grand for charity through the 28
Oh,
years.
amazing.
So
Amazing.
we like to give back, and it's another way of inspiring people and
Yeah.
trying to move humanity forward and letting people see their light.
Okay. Well, Hal, thank you so much. I will publish all that information in the show notes when I put this episode up real soon. And
Thank you.
ladies and gentlemen, as always, thank you so much. Thank you for joining us here in the inaugural episode of the fourth season of the Failure Guy podcast. And remember always that life is not a competition. If life is any sort of a race, it's a race that you run with yourself. And the only person you ever have to compare yourself with is the person that you were yesterday. So, whatever you're up to in the world, remember, never quit, keep running, and I'll see you next episode.
Thank you.